Hi, everybody. This is Martha Creek, and I'm delighted to be here today, and I want to welcome you to the 2021 New Thought Walden Awards podcast series. This one is extraordinary, and the others may say that about theirs, but you'll see about this one. These awards are given to special people, a special group of people who use empowering spiritual ideas and philosophies, education, and action to change lives and to make our planet a better place. These are exclusive interviews gathered specifically for this event to honor Walden Award. The Waldens are a unique partnership of 8 of the country's largest New Thought organizations, including Unity, Centers for Spiritual Living, Association for Global New Thought, Agape International Spiritual Center, Universal Federation for Better Living, the Affiliated New Thought Network, ANTIN, Divine Science Federation International, and the International New Thought Alliance. So thank you for joining us. And today I have our honoree in interfaith and intercultural understanding, Milagros Phillips. Welcome, and thank you for this, and congratulations on this recognition. And this
thank you so much. I am so honored. I am so honored. I can't find the words. I'm just so honored to be.
I've got a lot of questions now, so I'm just knowing that this is blessing the whole of the planet, and this empowering education that you're bringing, which you speak about it in terms of healing and education. So I'd like to open with that, like what you see as the difference and why both are important and how you approach this relative to race healing and race education or education around racism.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. So, excuse me, race literacy is a concept that I use. I actually wrote a book called 11 Reasons to Become Race Literate, because I've been doing this work for more than 30 years, and I have a particular program that I do that takes 2 days. And what I noticed was that the biggest aha with people was how little they knew about their own history with race. And so I realized that that's one of the places where the juice is, right? So I focus a great deal on that. And for me, race literacy is the conscious awareness of the history of race, the ways in which we are acculturated into a racial caste system, the impact that that has on all of us, and the ways in which we have absorbed, whether we're conscious or not, the ways that we have absorbed that system. So it's really a deeper understanding. And as far as the healing, for me, what I realized in doing this work for so long, excuse me, that was that people are absorbing this thing that we call race, which is a myth, right? There are no genetic differentiation between one group or human group and another human group. But that myth gave rise to racism, and racism is real, right? And what I realized in doing this work was that not only was racism something that affected people at the level of the mind, but it also affected people emotionally, it affected people physically. And so for me, if we're going to heal, we need to look at the impact of racism on all of us as a human family in mind, body, spirit, and emotions. And so that's why I talk about it from the perspective of healing. It's at the point where we are right now, we need to treat the whole being. We need to treat the whole person.
Yeah. Well, I certainly say amen to it. And that was one of the things that prompted me in this direction toward you specifically in the work that you do, because I have some caution about believing that we start to tout these principles or these new clever keywords that we're using and white fragility, nothing against that, mm-hmm. but that without a deep inner work about this and how I term it as to to get back in touch with what's in my bones and blood about this, that I made no conscious choice about, that I'm unaware that I have this in my bones and blood. Nevertheless, it's in my bones and blood. Then this is for work for all of us. Mm-hmm. And you have spoken about this now, that this, how you defined that race literacy, which I wrote down from listening to a TED talk that you did. So I want that on the recording, that not only have you been at this for 35 years, but you have been really at this. So you're speaking about this in with corporate leaders, with members of Congress, and that with anybody that'll take the time to come in here and do this important, I think vital, critical, essential work that you're speaking about. And that it's about information, certainly, transformation, certainly, and then some type of inspired action. And in that, you ask that we take risk, that we be able to take some risk. And I feel like I have over my life, and I am also aware that I've not been willing to, because I was so worried about doing it wrong, that I would approach it wrongly, or that I could offend somebody that I have deep respect for and admiration for, because I was blind to how much of this may be running in my own subconscious or in my own unconscious avenue. So part of my risk was to say, I'm going into this. I'm going toward this now. I'm not turning away from this anymore, out of the sphere of this. So speak about that. Like, what risk do you think we could take, should take, and that you believe in some way is essential for us to take in order for racial literacy, literacy around race, and healing this?
So one of the main things with, certainly with my work and the way that I approach it, is we need to have compassion for one another. There's a lot of, I don't know what I don't know when it comes to the issue of race, because a lot of the history has not been told, and it certainly has not been taught to us in school. There's been segregation of history. So, you know, when you segregate history, what happens is that you segregate history and then you segregate human beings, right? So you don't have a neighbor that you can speak to about some of these things, right? That may not look like you. And so there's a lot of information that we don't know, but we need that information to heal. And so for me, you know, having some understanding of the history is extremely important, because when we go to the doctor because we need healing for something, one of the first things they have you do is to just, you know, give a brief history of what happened in your family, what did your ancestors, what diseases assailed them, or, you know, what did they die of, and things like that. So it's important for us to understand our ancestral history around this stuff. And then understanding how, you know, life is a continuum. We don't just chop and then here's another piece of life, right? Like, life is a continuum. And so there's a story about us as a human family that needs to be told with all its pieces. And because we don't have all the pieces, it's hard for people to get to that place of compassion. So the expectation is that you're supposed to get it right. And it isn't about, that's not the journey. The journey is you have to take risks, because we're all going to mess it up. I've been doing this for a long time. I don't always get it right, you know, and it's because it's so deeply embedded within us that there's stuff inside of us that we don't even know exists, you know, until you're having a conversation and you blurt something out. Yeah. And the other reality around that is, if we don't know the history and we don't understand the continuum and the connection to our history, we keep thinking that we're creating something new, and all we're doing is repeating stuff that didn't work in the past, and it won't work today. And what is it Einstein said, that you know, you can't solve your problems with the same consciousness that created it? I'm paraphrasing, but that's basically what it is. And so we have a consciousness that was created over hundreds of years, and we all have absorbed it in one form or another. And that's what we all need to heal from. And so we need to have patience with each other and compassion with one another, because none of us is ever going to get it right all of the time. And because if we are ever going to change this, we have to create what I call sacred space, where we have to create room within ourselves to allow people to make mistakes, and to not get it right. I remember when my children were little, I used to always tell them, look, you tell me the truth, I'm not going to punish you. Now, I have to admit, there were times they told me the truth. I really wanted to punish them. But I knew that if I broke my word, they wouldn't trust me anymore, right? Mm-hmm. And so when it comes to the issue of race, we want people to take risks. We want people to tell the truth according to their story, right? But then we don't want to hear it when they tell us. And you know, and I don't care what side of the spectrum we're on, we all do this kind of stuff and we need to stop it. We need to be able to listen with an open heart and an open mind and realize that because of the way, it, you know, and I call it, it actually is a caste system that was set by the Spaniards when they, and the Portuguese when they started to arrive in the, what, you know, they call the New World. That caste system still exists today. The thing about that caste system was that it was absorbed differently based on where you were in the caste system. So white people internalized it as supremacy. And white people hear that word and they hear it as a bad word because of the way, you know, that, that we've put it together. But what supremacy actually is access, opportunity, immunity, and freedom. Brown people and black people absorb the same caste system, but they absorbed it differently. So how they absorbed it was through colonization and enslavement and a great deal of violence that allowed for that to happen. And so when they hear, you know, things that are racist, they can get triggered or they want to say something about it. And a white person is hearing the same thing, but they're hearing it through different filters.
Absolutely. That is so profound to me, all of this, frankly, but all that's particular spot there. So would you go over that list of four again about where this started and how we acclimated this, how we were acculturated into that, those four levels of that supremacy?
Yeah. So there are actually three levels and it's supremacy, which is how white folks internalized it. Colonization and enslavement for brown people or indigenous people, and enslavement and colonization for black people in this side of the world. On the other side of the world, so let's say Africa, it was colonization and enslavement. So one came before the other, right? Because very often people will say, well, you know, so there were people in Africa that were selling their own people into slavery. And that's absolutely true. But how that happened was because they had been colonized, and no one ever talks about that. They had been colonized and institutionalized into doing the stuff that they did. And so, you know, when we look at this stuff, it's very complex because it happened differently in different parts of the world. But the result is the same everywhere, where we have this racial conditioning that made for a condition of racism. And so when people understand that it is a condition, then we can start to talk about it from the perspective of healing. And, you know, because that makes it, that's the tweak, right? That's the little piece. And, you know, when we look at it from that perspective, then fragility takes on a different form, what we call white fragility. Because when we look at it from the perspective of, you know, so we're looking at it from the condition of racism. One of the things that happens to white folks when we want to have a conversation on race is you literally, regardless of whether they're having a conversation on race with another white person or with a person of color or with a black person, what happens is their stress response gets triggered. So it's fight, flight, or paralysis. Now, when you understand that racism is a condition, right, it's easier to understand how people react to it, interact with it. And, you know, without that background stuff, without the context, all we do is beat up on each other and every conversation about race turns into an argument. Because people don't understand that there's a history behind that is extremely important for us to grasp. We need the context to understand what is happening today. And if we're ever going to change tomorrow, we need the context so that we don't keep repeating the same old stuff, thinking we're creating something new. And if we're going to create something new, we need to start from today. Today can become anew when we understand. But without that historical context, it's very difficult for us to reach that place of healing.
Absolutely. And even to bring understanding and compassion to that we are triggered, that we don't know the difference between discomfort and this is going to kill me. Yes. It's like it's uncomfortable. It's not fatal.
Yeah.
And the bear is to grow some stamina and an uncommon motivation to bear that discomfort mm-hmm. for the matters that you're speaking of. So the piece, and I didn't refer to it accurately, but the piece I wanted you to repeat for this recording is the piece about supremacy. And it was defined then as our opportunities in that. So would you speak that again for me?
Sure. Sure. Yeah. It's access, opportunity, immunity, freedom, and there's several others there, but those are the four basic ones. And so from the perspective of supremacy, a white person will say something to another white person. There's a person of color that's listening, and the person of color will say, wow, that's really racist. The white person, you just trigger their stress response, right? So they're gonna fight you to defend themselves, right? Or they're going to want to get out of there really quick, or they become paralyzed, right? Like the body's there, but the soul has gone. Right. And so you're speaking to this empty shell, and, you know, and then that white person will turn to the other person, the other white person, and say, I didn't say anything racist, did I? And the white person will say, no, you didn't. She's not a racist. Why are you, you know, and so, and then it goes on like that. Right. When in reality, these two white folks are speaking a different language. They're speaking from the filters of what they have internalized, which is they're speaking through the filters of supremacy. Through the filters of supremacy, you do not hear racism. You don't see racism. Racism doesn't even exist, right? Because you're not experiencing the micro and macro aggressions of racism on a regular basis that people of color are. So people of color are more sensitive to hearing it, feeling it, sensing it, speaking it, right? And so because it's the way you stay safe. You need to know who the racists are in the group, right? Because, yeah. Because you need to be able to stay away from them in certain situations, right? And so we've been trained to hear it, see it, feel it. And as a result, we can say, wow, that was really racist, right? But to two white people, they're hearing it from the filters of the press, so they don't hear it. And the way that the system has been structured, because racism is institutional, systemic, internalized, and interpersonal, right? We interact it with one another because we've internalized it from the system, right? And so from that perspective, when you break it down, what you're really talking about, what you're really seeing, and what you're really sensing is that people speak different languages. So they end up arguing with one another rather than having an intelligent conversation where everybody brings their awareness to the table and we can compassionately hear them with an open heart and an open mind. Everybody's in defense mode.
Yeah.
And one of the teachings from supremacy is supremacy teaches white people not to see racism. And here's why. We are all human. Human beings at their core love other human beings. That's who we are. You see it with little children, you see it with babies, right? And what happens with racism is racism is about segregation. So it's not just about external segregation, but it's also about internal segregation. Because you have to literally separate your mind from your heart to be able to do this thing, okay, that we've all been trained to do. And so here you are, with your natural state of being, which is love and connection and unity, being asked to or being made to separate yourself from other people, regardless of the color that you're being made to do that, right? So that causes cognitive dissonance and it separates the mind and the heart. And I love this phrase that Carolyn Mays used, and I think it was in Anatomy of the Spirit, when she said, if your heart and your head are in two different places, you will be an addict. And we are one of the most addicted nations in the world. We're also one of the most depressed nations in the world, in spite of the fact that we have more money than everybody else, pretty much. You know, and so it's like, how do you explain that, right? How do you explain that?
Well, I like to use that because it helped me this year. Like when I looked, and part of my education has been, and since these, the of what happened in this past year, caused me to roll up my sleeves, get back in here, and to do it in a way, at a depth and a breadth that I just hadn't done, even with desire, even with intent. So, and it included me reading stories of people's experiences, Black people's lived lives, to educate myself and to get this disconnect dealt with to any degree that I could. So powerful, powerful stories, and included hearing in the education process of listening to some of these leaders and speakers in this that were afraid of being seen as a supremacist. But if I heard those four things you just said, I would have been far more open to that. Like, I don't deny supremacy. I don't, there's not a morsel of me that denies it, but I'm so much more open to, I can look at these things, accessibility and opportunity and other things, from an entirely different open-heartedness and compassionate mind than hearing it labeled up and tied up and wrapped up somehow. The same way with racists. Like, we get some notion that racist is a Ku Klux Klan member wearing this and going around with their gun, shooting anybody that's not their skin color, lynching people. And it's like, I'm not that. I am not that. But it's like, that's a spectrum of where I am. And I'm just a thought away from that. You know, I'm just a thought away from that. If I had in my bones and blood what they did, I'd be over there doing that too. So to stay open to, it's not a question of if we are, just where am I that, how am I that, and what's left of that. Yeah. So I wanted to ask you about this notion that of this platitude of, we're all one, we're all one. There is no race, which is absolute reality. I believe, and you speak it, so apparently you believe it. Where there is no race,
well, there's science behind it as well.
Yeah,
like, there's that. To show that we're one family,
or like science, there's that. Yeah. But this slippery slope of saying we're all one. But back here at the ranch, there's some work to do about that. So would you just speak to that, and any tendency to bypass this spiritually, or attempts to bypass this, and how that's compounding this and exponentially affecting this? So any caution around our spiritual platitudes on this?
Yeah, so it's I believe what you're referring to is equity versus equality, right? Like, those are two completely different things. Like, the phrase that we've sold people is separate but equal. Yes, it was separate, but it was never equal, right? Like, even the water fountains were never equal, right? Some of them got clean and some of them did not, right? And so, so what we're dealing with is all of the ways in which we want to believe, because we want to believe that we are all equal and that we all have equal opportunity and equal rights and all of those kinds of things. But the reality is, we don't. It's as simple as that. I mean, like, we just don't. And we don't because of the way things have been structured. And they have been structured racially. And you know, every once in a while, I meet people who go, it's not a race problem, it's an economic problem. No, the race problem also spills over to economics, just like it spills over to housing, spills over to education. It's like butter spread all over your bread, right? And so what we're dealing with is something that impacts all levels of society, but none of it has ever been equal. It just has not been equal. And, you know, for instance, I'll give you one example. So, after the Emancipation Proclamation, when the people who had been enslaved were supposed to get 40 acres and a mule and did not, most of them did not get that. That was the reparations, right? But slave owners sued the U.S. government even before the enslaved folks were set free for $300 per person for loss of property. So how equal is that? you know, and they got it. They got reparations, but the people who had been enslaved did not. So it's just never, ever been equal. And the part of us that wants to say that and wants to believe that is the part of us who by nature knows we are one human family and we should be connected. We are one global village and we have a lot of cousins all over the place, right? So that's our heart. That's our spirit. That's our soul. That's our nature. That's, you know, who we are. But we are born into a world that has been institutionalized racially. And as a result, who we are gets covered over by a lot of layers of dysfunction and a lot of myths and a lot of lies. And it's very hard for people to heal on a lie. It's not going to happen.
Yeah.
Because what happens is you end up healing the lie and working around the lie, thinking that you're healing the problem, but you're not.
Yeah.
You're just working with the lie.
Yeah.
Right. And so if we're going to do this work, we have to recognize that it just has never been equal. But the desire for equality is there because that's who we are. That's how our soul knows us.
Mm-hmm. So I'm going to hear humanity doing a global amen. Or whatever your word for, so be it, so be it, so be it.
Amen will do
for me. So be it, so be it. Amen, amen, amen. I also have in my notes regarding this a term called axiology.
Oh,
it really struck me. Can we've only got a few minutes? Can you speak a little bit about that? Yeah. How that's
Dr. Edwin Nichols' work, and axiology is the study of values based on culture and environment, and how people value things based on where their tribes developed in the world. So people who developed in colder climates, who couldn't see. You know, they would look out 9 months out of the year, there isn't even a leaf on the tree. You know, they look out into a world of scarcity. People in warmer climates where the papaya is growing, if not the mango is growing, or the, you know, something's always in season, look out into the world and they see abundance. Mm-hmm. And the things that come from those points of view, those realities, and how, you know, when you don't have what to eat and you've got people to feed, you'll do whatever you have to do to feed yourself and feed your people. And how that became something that then seeped into the culture. And we call it the object. Food is the object. Like, you've got to have the objects if you're going to survive, right? The thing that happened was that over time, people in colder climates began to objectify everything. They objectified women, they objectified children, they objectified everything. And what happens when you objectify everything, in order to objectify a human being, you have to, in your mind, remove their humanity. And as a result, we're living with basically axiology gone awry, which is the people, the northern people who had the swords, who had, you know, that's they could develop these things because those are the natural resources that were available to them, and how they use that to use violence to conquer the entire world, right? And the impact that still has on us today.
Yes. And certainly in this race and the colors of skin and that I got really shocked into awareness about that with these children in slavery and sexual use of children. And some of the men that were sharing about that shared that there was no connection there. They did not see it as a human. They couldn't even comprehend how they could not see it as a human, but they didn't see it as a human. It was like a transaction. Yeah. Like, I worked all day, went and had sex with a child and went home to my family.
Yeah.
And this disconnect with what?
Yeah,
what?
But in order to do those things and in order to violate another human being, you have to disconnect your heart from your head. Because you just say, you know, the more whole you are, the more coherence you have, the less likely you are to be violent toward another human being. I used to tell my children when they were little, figure out what makes you happy, because happy people don't make war. Yeah. You know, this is not complicated. Happy people don't make war. They're always trying to figure out how they can make you laugh, or let's go dance together, or let's have fun together. They're not trying to figure out how to kill you. Okay. I mean, that's just not going to happen. So, you know, so yeah, what we're dealing with is a lot of pain, a lot of dysfunction, and, you know, just people's hurts, yeah, that, you know, we know from research that traumatized people traumatize others. We know this. Yeah. And yet we continue to traumatize people, yeah, and then wonder why they're so violent. It's like, yeah.
Well, which brings us into this healing racism, healing and being racially literate from the inside out, which I hope will speak to your work. So will you put that here on the recording for us, please, about how people can find you, generally what you're about, and inspire us and encourage us. I told you already before I started here, I'll be there. I'm enrolled.
Oh, wonderful.
Just lay out here for the recording. So milagrosphillips.com is where it's all listed, everything you've got going on there. Yeah. So a little word about what that work would be like, or some encouragement for people that really have had just enough of this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, to, yeah.
Risk and take some action. So speak to us about that. What
sure,
we
were. Yeah, no, and I love working with people who are ready to do the work, right? Because the work is internal. And so you can get information about the workshop from milagrosphillips.com. It's a 2-day immersion. And what I'm gonna say about that is I've been doing that particular seminar since 2001. And the only thing that's changed is, you know, as I grow and I change, there's more research, there's better information. Like, we started out with 8 layers of the healing process. I now do 12 layers of the healing process. So the first day, we look at, you know, how to make these connections with, you know, with yourself, with your history, with your family, and what's happened in the world, and so on and so forth. The second day, we move through those 12 layers of healing. And I have to say, I've been doing that particular workshop, as I said, for 20 years this year. And I have people who went through this workshop 18 years ago, 15 years ago, 10 years ago, who have never forgotten it. They talk about how it's still working in their lives. It takes about 45 days after you do that work for the information to seep in. And then all of a sudden, it's like, you know, and the reason I can say this is because of the feedback from people who have done it. We've had literally thousands of people go through that workshop. And the feedback is always the same. It's like, oh my gosh, I healed all this stuff with my family, right? Because the work is the same as, you know, with, it's the micro and the macro, right? So how we heal our families is how we heal our communities, and it's how we heal our world. And so people suddenly realize, oh my God. And the other thing that I think is wonderful is people leave inspired. They suddenly realize, you know, they come in thinking this is unmanageable because it's so big, right? Mm-hmm. And they leave feeling like there is something I can do. I had no idea. I wrote this in one of my books. I had this lawyer who had attended the program, and we do visioning at the end. And she said in her vision, she was trying to figure out, you know, what can I do? What can I do? And on the drive home, she realized I can contact my school and, you know, where I went to school and see if they're interested in me doing a program on race. And she did. And the first semester, they had like 16 students, then it doubled, then it just continued to grow. And so people leave inspired knowing that this is not bigger than them, because if the problem is bigger than us, then it's got us.
Yeah, yeah.
But if we become bigger than the problem, we have it. And when we have it, we can change it.
And the humanity says, amen. Amen, amen, amen. My unspeakable thanks to you for your devotion, your life, your mind, your heart, your wholeness, and the service that you've made to make this world a better place to be and to evolve us. So I sincerely bow to you and thank you.
Oh my gosh, thank you so much. I'm so honored. And can I just tell you real quick, dude, like what this means to me? First of all, I don't get a lot of awards. I do race work. Nobody wants to talk to me. But anyway, but what I want to say about
up until now.
That's right. Up until now. That's right. Life is changing. how much this means to me. I have to just tell you real quick that this feels like a gift from the ancestors, and I'll tell you why. Years ago, before I was doing race work or any of that stuff, my mother used to get Unity Magazine and Daily Word. We used to also get Daily Word. And when I found out about this award, I called my niece and said, what was that magazine that my mother used? And my niece said, yeah, Granny used to read to me from that all the time. So this feels like a gift from my ancestors. And it feels like a yes from my ancestors because my father used to read Daily Word. My mother used to read Daily. I used to read Daily Word. And I can't tell you how many times I've called the 800 number for prayer. So this is, you know, like, I'm just so honored and humbled and grateful, so grateful for this award, because it feels like it's coming from the ancestors. So thank you all so much for that. It just brings tears to my eyes. I cried when I first heard, because it felt like it was just coming from the ancestors.
Well, I absolutely believe it. So bowing to the ancestors and thanking them too, and for your work and for the Walden Awards and the consciousness that brings us about for us to take another look. So thank you again. Godspeed to you. I'll see you. And I hope if you're listening to this, you hurry over there to that website and sign yourself up for something. Take your own risk to do this. So all of you who's listening, thanks for joining us and for knowing that this inspirational talk and education and healing has occurred right here and right now through this 2021 New Thought Walden podcast. You can subscribe to these or any of the other interviews on Apple, Google, Spotify, Stitcher, wherever you get them. And to find out about past honorees and the work they're doing, or to nominate future recipients for the Walden Award, go to waldenawards.com. So God bless you. Namaste. And I'll see you. Yeah. My sleeves are rolled up. I'm here working with you. Yeah. All blessings.
Thank you.
Thank you, everybody. MarthaCreek.com. If I can support you, blessings.